Let me tell you a story, podcast number 144.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Call me Ishmael.
It was the age of wisdom.
Some years ago.
It was the age of fools.
Never mind.
It is a truth universally acknowledged.
You don't know about me without you.
Welcome to Let Me Tell You a Story with your hosts, Steve and Becky Lyles. Settle back into your seat. Step onto your favorite fitness machine or lace up your walking shoes and enjoy stories from a variety of genres and authors.
Hi, I'm Steve.
Hi, this is Becky. Welcome to Let Me Tell You a Story. Today, we are privileged to talk with a third author who's written a Jewish grandfather story. Sounds idyllic, right? Not so much. These narratives all include World War II timelines. Our first author, Orange Schneider, wrote about his grandfather's Nazi prison camp internment in The Apprentice of Buchenwald. Then we talked with Martin Bodek about his book, Zaidi's War, which chronicles his grandfather's conscription into four armies, sometimes at gunpoint during World War II. Today's guest, Hands of Gold author Ronnie Robbins, fictionalized her grandfather's story. In some ways, it's similar to the previous two accounts, yet, in a sense, far removed from them. But before we begin, Steve will read an abbreviated version of Ronnie's extensive publishing bio and welcome her to the podcast.
Hands of Gold, One Man's Quest to Find the Silver Lining in Misfortune, capitalizes on award-winning author Ronnie Robbins, 35 years as a published writer. Currently an editor-writer for Medscape/Web. MD, after serving as associate editor of the Atlanta Jewish Times / the Times of Israel, she has a seasoned history as a staff reporter for daily and weekly newspapers and as a freelancer for national, regional, and online publications. In addition to major CEOs and politicians, she has interviewed such celebrities as Wolf Blitzer, Andy Gibb, Hank Aaron, and Usher. Robbins won 3 Simon Rockauer Awards for Jewish Journalism from the American Jewish Press Association. Other prestigious news writing awards come from the State Bar of Georgia, the Alabama Associated Press, and the South Carolina Press Association. In 2009, Hands of Gold, her first novel, was a quarterfinalist for historical fiction in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award Contest. Wow. Ronnie, you've been busy. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, this opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
Yep, glad to have you.
Ronnie, I hear you recently won another award for Hands of Gold. Please tell us about it.
So I've won 2 other awards since the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award Contest. I won American Fiction Award. I was a finalist for Family Saga. And then I won more recently International Book Award. I was a winner in multicultural fiction. And I just found out that I won a Global Book Award that I was a finalist. And I think historical fiction, but I haven't received all of the details yet on that, but that's coming soon. So probably by next week, I'll know those details.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Wow.
Very excited about the recognition. Doesn't exactly sell books. It doesn't exactly translate into selling books, but it's nice to be recognized that the book is being well received.
Well, sure. And that it was well done.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that means so much to a journalist, to a writer, full-time writer. That's my profession. I better do it right. I better be able to at least write a quality publication. Yes.
Well, it's also good to know that all that time, I know you spent years at this, was well worth it.
Yes, I spent 20 years while I was raising my children and freelancing from some major big publications. I kept my hand in my career, and I also was working on this book. So this is something that I've been a journalist for 35 years, but I probably have worked on this book more than 20 years. So, and that mirrors the growth of my children and the ages of my children. So yes, it is, definitely a labor of love and an investment of time into something that I hope is worthwhile and reaps benefits.
Definitely. So I have a couple thoughts before we get going. First, I edit a lot of fiction, and I have to say I'm impressed that Hands of Gold is not only well written, it's an interesting story, and you use all of the senses. Oftentimes, authors only tell their stories visually. They don't include smells, sounds, tastes, and touch sensations. Kudos to you for a story we can wrap our senses around.
Thank you. And I think that that's what we try to accomplish as writers. I think I was very aware of that, you know, that it not be a tell story, but that it's an emotional, like you said, using all those senses. I used all those senses. I wanted them, the reader, to feel like they were there. I wanted them to, wiggle their nose when onions smell, potent. And I wanted them to feel sad when the characters felt sad. I wanted them to be excited when romance was blooming. So yes, that was part of my decision to, and goal to capture those senses in hopefully almost on every page. So, and studying, writing has helped that because no story should be a tell. No story of fiction. No storytelling should be just a tell, because that's boring to me. Each his own.
So true. At the end of the book, you include some of the Yiddish terms you sprinkle throughout the novel. I was pleasantly surprised to see that some of those terms have snuck into everyday American English, like chutzpah and dreck. So if Yiddish is not Hebrew, what is it? And do you speak Yiddish?
So I don't speak Yiddish. My grandparents, of course, spoke Yiddish. My parents know Bissell a little. I know a little because I studied it as a teenager. But I wanted this to be in the language, some of the language that they would have spoken, that they would have used in Europe. So that's why I sprinkled it in. And yes, I tried to choose the words that would be most common for others and across faiths, meaning that Christians, Muslims, and others could get a sense of that environment even if they didn't speak the language. And then most people don't know that there's a glossary in the back, so they still tell me, those that read it say, I knew most of the words, or I got a sense of it without knowing what the meaning was. I don't speak Hebrew fluently either. I go to synagogue regularly. I'm very active in my synagogue, and we read Hebrew, but it's not a language that I know. In Israel, they speak it. They use it regularly, but I understand some words, but really I can read it.
Mm-hmm. So, kind of like Latin in the Catholic Church?
Yes. Yes, we don't use Yiddish as much as Hebrew in our services, but a lot of people know it. Unfortunately, as the generations move on, I'm not sure if my children will have an appreciation for this language of our ancestors as I did, as my parents did. And of course, as their parents used regularly, to hide things from the children, I might add.
Yeah. Well, I did read that Yiddish is, what, the basis is German? Is that right?
There is a lot of commonality between German and Yiddish, but I think, and yes, Germanic languages, I'm not an expert, but I believe there is some overlap, it was all over Europe, so I'm not sure. That would be an interesting study to do, how much of it actually came from Germany itself. I just know that this was the language that they used in their insular worlds away from the Germans. So I'm not sure if the Germans, I just don't know. I don't know how much the Germans understood of this language. My feeling is that they didn't, that their language was different. And Jews knew the German. They knew their language of the areas that they lived. If they lived in Germany, they knew the country's language, but they also had this secret language. I believe it was secret.
So there could have been many dialects, I guess it's the word, from, you know, whether they were in Hungary or Czechoslovakia.
Correct.
Or,
correct. Yeah. It just, you know, we're an educated people. We're the people of the book. We're known as the people of the book. Mm. And I think that, you know, we tend to be educated because we have, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that we have to do, you know, Hebrew school, and, you know, many, many Jewish families send their children to Hebrew school. So they're learning dual languages. And so that helps push us into being well versed in languages and just education.
Yeah, being studious.
You mentioned in the book that your grandfather recorded his life story on cassette tapes. Why did you write it in novel form rather than biographical form?
So I get this question a bit. As a journalist, you know, it would seem like my forte would be to write real life experiences. And I wanted to protect the people, the real life people who are named in the, whose names I changed in the story. I also thought that I transcribed the tapes, so I knew what was on the tapes. And I think it needed a little bit more storytelling, and so I made it more exciting. So I changed some of the information from straight facts to fiction to make it more exciting, to make it more dramatic, and to also change many of the names to protect the innocent. Who some of them are still alive. So that's what I chose to do. Now, fiction is not something that I did study it in college, but, you know, all these years I've been writing nonfiction, so it would seem my strength would be in that. So it was definitely a challenge, and it challenged me to certainly to make up dialogue and to build on the basics that my grandfather set out for me in the cassette tapes. I thought you were going to ask me why cassette tapes. I mean, people won't know what cassette tapes are. You know, young children won't know what cassette tapes. Our generation, maybe I was writing it for our generation, the nostalgia of it, and let the others figure out what a cassette tape is. Years from now, they can look. It'll be an antique, but it'll give it some time period, to place a time stamp on it. Really, the first time that I listened to it, it was just to hear the story. I wasn't thinking I would write a book about this in the least. I didn't even know that I would do anything with this. I was just, my mom shared it with me, and I thought I was just, this is interesting stuff. And then I decided to write a column on it. And then from the column, I said, you know what? I'm going to write a book. So.
To begin at the beginning, the protagonist, Samuel Fox, was born in Hungary in 1905. His younger years in a peasant family, a farming family, were challenging and filled with hard work. Yet he was surrounded by family, food, and Judaism. But then life became difficult for Jews. One of the first clues was when he went to town with his father to sell a pair of oxen. His father refused several offers. About the time Samuel thought they might have to take the oxen home with them, the perfect buyer came along. Later, his father said, "Patience, son. Nothing good ever comes from acting too rashly." A good life lesson for Sam. However, he learned a different lesson on the way home when they were attacked by the teenage boys.
So there was a lot of anti-Semitism at that time, and I'm not sure whether this was anti-Semitism or just boys being boys. And they were confronted on the way home, and so they tried to report this to the government, and the government just sort of ignored them, the police, I should say. Ignored them because this incident, the police looked the other way, and that's just what Jews at that time had to accept. So this was just the indications that the police, the government, were not valuing their citizens at the same level that maybe they disregarded because of the fact that the complainants were Jewish. So that's just some of the dangers that Jewish people had to deal with back before World War II, because anti-Semitism had existed for a long time.
Right, which is had to be terribly frustrating.
Yeah.
But then his dad kind of took justice into his own hands, if I remember right. I'm not remembering exactly, but he did let the boys know that they weren't to mess with him again.
Right. So if the police weren't going to help you, then at your own risk, you had to show that you're not going to be intimidated. And I think that if this was our generation, you know, you would have to think twice about going up against authority or, you know, how you'd want to handle it. So you have to think, this is where the reader can go into their own mind and say, listen, there's cases, a father, a daughter gets raped. Would they, if they feel like justice isn't being served, is it worth it to go after the perpetrator? So, you know, these kind of incidents that happened, how much are you willing to risk your own life to make a point? Certainly it was dangerous for Jews to do that. And my grandfather is seeing his father as a strong man, as a strong role model, and then later on follows that example to stand up for his right. There are all these lessons in the novel, which were also put there for a purpose.
Well, skipping ahead in the book, Samuel was a teenager when he traveled far from home twice. Where did he go? How did he get there? And why? And what kind of survival tactics did he employ? It's a lot of questions all at once.
And you may need to remind me. So he did. He left his home. He left the comfort of his home and crossed several countries to escape, to be someplace different than where he grew up, to possibly make a better life for himself away from the struggles that he saw his family experiencing. And he did learn to trust his intuitions. He learned to go to places that he knew that he would find people to help him. And he lived off the land. He used every bit of his intuitions and his strength as a persistent person to be able to fulfill his dream of getting to America, which was his goal. And he got turned around a few times. He tried and then he realized he couldn't do it. And then he went back to the comfort of his family. And then he tried again. So try and try again. And sometimes practicality forces you to retreat. But don't give up on your dreams, which is something that I hope that people walk away with from the story too, is, you know, if you have a dream of doing something, then figure out how to make it happen. And I certainly have in my own personal experience with this book. So I've learned the generations repeat itself, and I have heard loud and clear to test the limits and to go forth and not give up on your goals.
Well, if I remember right, his mother she had mixed feelings. She didn't want her son to leave home. She was afraid he'd lose his Judaism, or he would eat non-kosher food, be subject to the world's ways. But also, she wanted him to go because he was just about, draft age. It wasn't the Hungarian army, it was the Czech army, right? That was very close to enlisting him against his will.
And right.
So he was trying to avoid that, but there was also him thinking of the mother. She was concerned about his safety, I suppose, being in the army during the war. Although the war hadn't yet, World War II hadn't started yet then, but the Russians were always a threat.
Right, as they, you know, they still are. Yes, so see how history repeats itself.
Yes.
Yes, as a Jewish family, there were always concerns about mixing with Gentiles and adopting their ways and losing your Judaism. And there was that fear, but there was also the fear of him being conscripted, brought and having to fight for his country. And they didn't want him to, you know, volunteer or anything. And that actually comes up later in the novel with the main character's children volunteering to serve. But back then, he didn't want, that was not his interest. And so he did escape, and then took his life in his hands to go back, and avoid being, you know, being found out. And there were those secrets, hiding that information that he was still alive. So there was always risk involved in this. There's a lot of risk involved in that experience. Mm-hmm. But yes, so there's the duality of a bunch of risks at once, you know, and the main character tried his best to not go against his family's wishes for him to eat non-kosher, but I don't get into that as much, but yes, the Jewish mother's fears never end.
Yeah, I understand that. So here, I'll mention that a gold watch played a significant part in this story. But that's all I'll say about it. However, speaking of gold, that's how Samuel thought of America. His older siblings. Some of them had gone to America, which became his goal too, as you said. And even to him, the name sounded like a miracle. I think of the movie American Tail, where expectations are not necessarily reality. But Sam didn't go directly to the United States. Instead, he landed in Canada. Why?
He actually jumped ship in Canada. I believe he found work there and he had family in Canada. And later his wife had family in Canada, so they had that in common. But he was looking to get off the ship. He didn't want to have to return with the ship to Europe. He knew that it was close to America, and then he would make his way to America and across borders, which is another exciting segment of the book.
You might explain, he worked his way across the ocean. He wasn't just a passenger on the ship.
Right.
He worked. You might talk about that a little bit. Which had to do with why he was expected to return on the ship.
He actually found work. He found a way to get from Europe to America to get to Canada was to work on the ship. In that he was a worker on the ship, he would have to return with the ship to Europe. And he decided that he wasn't going to do that, that this was his way of getting to where he wanted to go, at least partway, was to work on the ship. And they all had a little stopover in Canada and he decided, I'm not getting back on the ship. So he used that as he knew he was again going to be violating not following the correct path and definitely being a fugitive again. But I guess he got used to this and made his way across from Canada to New York. But he, as far as the gold goes, gold has so many meanings. It's richness, it's golden years that eventually play in the novel. This story follows his experiences from childhood to the end, and those were the golden years. That's a real big part of the story. And Jews at that time referred to America as the golden Medina, the golden land. Mm-hmm. So, and also he says, and I think it was true back then too, they thought that the streets were paved with gold because Americans had so much money. I don't think he realized that was just a story and that the streets weren't really made of gold. Certainly there are stories about gold, The Wizard of Oz and the Yellow Brick Road but he never found that the streets were made of gold, but he didn't know that. That was the story that people told.
He was still in Canada when he met Hannah, who would become his wife, but then she moved to New York City and he followed her there. He was a wanted man in those days. So for him, crossing the border between the two countries was a scary proposition. If he was caught, he could be deported. How did he manage to get across without triggering an arrest?
And I should add that he was a wanted man because he was running from the Czech government, right?
Correct. So there was a lot of risk, but that was part of the whole experience for him. So he got lucky. And the shooter said run, and he ran. They were manning the borders. So he used an opportunity to take his life in his hands, and he had luck all the way along. because this story is an adventure story. And luck is part of our lives in general anyway. it's being lucky. It's being at the right place at the right time. And then I'll use a Yiddish word, having chutzpah. chutzpah. So he had that maybe from learning it from his father, which his father used too. He decided that his goal was worth it, and he was willing to take whatever risks were involved to make that happen. And I don't know how you have that fearlessness, but he had it. And I hope we all have it when our life calls for it in tricky situations. And he was young. Let's also add that. And in school, maybe at that point. What did he have to really go back to, I guess? There were risks on either side, and he took them.
Oh, yeah.
So this appears later in the story, but Sam came to a realization. In his words, "Finally, I understood what America was about, working hard to succeed." Both Sam and Hannah worked hard, first to support themselves and eventually to feed and clothe 5 children. However, Sam's work was interrupted several times, and Hannah had to carry the load alone. Please talk about his health issues.
So my grandfather had tuberculosis, which, if you're following the news, tuberculosis is in the news again. Uh-huh. So it felt like it went away for a while, but then it's back. So as other illnesses are too, that we hear about. So because I cover healthcare, so I know
right.
that. But I think the more important story is that his life was not easy. And at a time when women were mostly homemakers, my grandmother became a breadwinner. And she was a strong woman in her own right and knew what she had to do to take care of her family when her husband was ill. Now, you know, you might say women are also tending to be caregivers. So she knew that there was no other alternative. So she had to help her husband, you know, be better, get well by being the one to support the family at a time when that wasn't common. Now it is, but it wasn't back then. And the woman stayed in the home. So the roles were reversed. My grandfather he almost died of tuberculosis, and he was a strong survivor of sorts. And there's a near-death experience in here in the book, and he was also a test case, or you'd say a clinical trial patient, for a type of TB treatment that's still around, streptomycin. So there is there's a lot of history in this book, and some of it is based on truth. And that's part of it, is that he helped save lives in that he allowed himself to be a test case for this experimental treatment at the time that's still used today because of his illness. And he eventually got better, but that's part of it too.
It's a long haul.
I think it was when their son served with the military overseas that they learned through him about the Holocaust and close family members who were murdered at Auschwitz. How did Sam react to that horrifying news?
So it was pretty shocking to them. That's this perspective that I'm giving in this, in my novel, is the guilt at having survived, at having known that he left behind that family, that he would have been there, but for the grace of God go I. He knew that he had escaped this. And yet, so there's one part of it that he's happy, of course, to be alive, but he didn't recognize that. He saw it as, that should have been me. Why didn't I stay? That guilt, that, you know, understanding that he might have been able to do more to help them to get out. Why didn't they? He tried to get them to come with him. Mm-hmm. They, you know, there was a lot, even in Hannah's family, where they said, no, we're, and I don't go into all that, how many she lost, but they didn't want to come to America because it wasn't as Jewish as it was, as they felt like that Europe was, that there was this risk of losing your Judaism, which was very important to them, to come here. So he wishes he could do more. And that really, that guilt really is a perspective that I don't know how many novels deal with. We talk about the survivors a lot, those that went through the experience, but what about those that didn't, mm-hmm. and yet lost all their family or lost so many of their family members? And what can you do? What can you do? And how unbelievable would it be for us to hear about that? Some madman is leading a country. I mean, we see it and we recognize it, but to hear about the horrors from afar, that only a little bit, you cannot even fathom that kind of inhumanity among people would happen, that people could treat each other so violently and just, you know, in such painful, horrible ways treat each other. Because they were different and because there was fear.
So incomprehensible. You know, it was like a virus just spread from Hitler. I'm sure he had plenty of others in his circle to begin with, but how that spread through not just Germans, but people who, like you say, anti-Semitism was a factor all along.
Yeah.
And as well as what it was, gypsies and people who were mentally not up to their standards,
and homosexuals, and so you know you can definitely relate it to how people who are different, who have a different lifestyle, who just want to do that which everyone does: raise families, be loved, live their lives the way they want to, just to be able to do that isn't always tolerated by those who feel like that they are better than.
So, if I did the math right, Samuel was 85 when he became a U.S. citizen. Is that right?
Your math is as good as mine. My math is not that good.
But he worked hard to attain that. He and Hannah both, I believe. But the day he became a citizen, he did something kind of naughty. So please tell us that story.
Oh, boy, you're going to have to remind me what he did. There's so many naughty things that they did.
Hey, this can't be excellent.
Sorry, Becky, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I haven't read my own book in a bit.
You know, I know what that's like. Somebody got on me the other day because I called one of the characters by the wrong name when she was talking about.
I'm so sorry.
Like, he kissed the Liberty Bell.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
And made, I don't know, the guards, I guess, were quite upset with him.
I'm pretty sure there's signs there. Don't touch the bell. You know, you also see people, I think, you know, kissing the ground kissing the ground of coming to America and kissing the ground, seems to be a common thing. I think that he took so many risks in his life that what's one more? And, you know, it's funny because I've heard this before from family members, and I won't name any, that feel that risk, to take risks in their life. And maybe some of what I, how I portrayed the main character is from other people that I'm close with, who feel like that you should do, and then instead of asking for permission, do, and then be told, no, don't, you know, that's not right. Mm-hmm. So there's the rebel in the main character that I wanted to bring out. He is naughty. I described him as somebody you love to hate sometimes, or you want to reprimand, for being wayward, for taking too many risks. I'm a very practical person, but I will tell you, some of the men in my life definitely take more risks than I would ever take. But it's exciting when you follow somebody who will push the limits. Sometimes, you know, it's the risk of life is can make things, it can add excitement to a very boring life, a very follow the rules type of life.
That's right.
Anna died before Sam. But before she passed, they shared lifelong secrets with each other for him to tell their children. Forgiveness was involved in that exchange. Later, Sam lists his regrets, like in the Sinatra song, My Way, regrets I've had a few. Did your grandparents really wait that long to share the secrets? Or did you make up their confessions for the story?
So... the original title of the book was Meet Me in Heaven, and Tie Up Loose Ends and Meet Me in Heaven was part of the beginning of the story. So I think the secrets are, I don't even know how much of the story I made up and how much came from the cassette tapes, because I'd have to listen to the cassette tapes again to tell you what is truth. And it's blurry in my mind also, which is actually good. Mm-hmm. So... the fact that they had to tie up loose ends, I don't know what those loose ends were. Could those be just really boring things like financials and closing, you know, getting money for the house and things like that? Or could they be other loose ends that were left unraveled, you know, that were left to unravel? There were some secrets that I found out from researching this book, of course. Of course, I grew up with my grandparents, but there was mystery beyond them that I didn't understand until I started delving into their story from the tapes and then masterminding the rest of it in my mind. and I think that, you know, some of us see our grandparents as like, what was life like before they were just your grandparents? and I do believe that there were some secrets that I'm not going to reveal what those secrets were. I played around with some facts, but some of them were close to reality, and I decided that would make the story more interesting to have all that drama, secrets, mystery, and having to go through the book to figure out what they are and what gets solved and what doesn't and what I might continue to unravel in the next book.
Oh,
cool.
Before we let Ronnie go, we'd like her to read a little bit from her book, Hands of Gold, and then we'll also provide information, ask her to provide information on how listeners can contact her.
January 1991, Manor Crest Nursing Care, Philadelphia. In sickness and health, could have done without so much of the sickness and a little bit more of the health. Would that have been so terrible? Back at the nursing home where Hannah and I have been living recently, the children came periodically to visit and take me to Hannah at General, where she was recuperating from a broken hip. The rest of the time, I mope around Manor Crest, this home for alter cockers like myself, schlepping this decrepit body through its brightly urine-stretched hallways just to have something to do. I nearly always pass a room with its door exposed to the occupant in some stage of undress. Was this how I also appeared to the, with layers of limp skin draped over a bowed frame like the branches of a weeping willow? I continued trudging to what was Hannah's room. That is her room before she fell a little over a week ago. We hadn't shared a bedroom in some time now, what with our unsynchronized snoring habits. Even at our home in Philly, we had separate beds. The family decided we were too fragile to stay there on our own anymore, especially Hannah. No one was able to help us as much as we needed it, and no one volunteered to take us in. Who could blame them? They had their own busy lives, and they didn't live nearby. As much as we hated to admit, we needed to be here. But now I was away from Hannah, and I couldn't stand it. Of course, whenever I asked to see her room at Manor Crest to feel close to her between visits to General, the attending nurse escorted me, unlocked the door, and let me in. I sat on the bed, inhaled Hannah's warm, comforting scent from her pillows, the patchwork quilt, and the woolen blanket she knitted a lifetime ago. Maybe it was the trace of potent menthol in the noxzema that masked her face nightly. Perhaps it was my vague recollection of the white shoulder she wore in healthier years that I longed to recapture in this now empty room. But I couldn't help to see her face in the mirror, combing her thick gray hair or applying some pale pink lipstick. She'd have lumbered across this room with legs often swollen from poor circulation. I could hear her voice berating the housekeeping services here. Can't trust anyone to do a decent job these days, she'd complain. Not the way I like it. Then she'd reorganize and refold and remake and restore, shaking her head in disapproval and frustration as she labored. It was her way, and I didn't question it.
Beautiful.
Yes. Well done.
Yeah, great excerpt.
How can our listeners contact you? Where can they get the book? All that kind of stuff.
So it is on Amazon and all other book retailers that you can think of, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Books A Million. And you can also find me at www.ronnierobbins.com. You can buy the book there. You can buy it through my publisher, Amsterdam Publishers. I am all over social media. I have 4 Facebooks, 2 Twitters. I have an Instagram. I have a TikTok. I have, I'm missing, I think, let's see, LinkedIn. So I only have 1 LinkedIn, but I have duplicates of some of the others. Certainly, I have a author's page, and they're either under Ronnie Kane Robbins, that was my maiden name, K-A-Y-N-E, or it's under Ronnie Robbins, or Hands of Gold Novel. So you can find me, you can Google me. You may find many of my articles instead of the book, but it is available out there. So as easy as Google and spelling my name right and Hands of Gold, you will find ways to purchase the book. And I certainly hope that people will take the time to do that, and that the book will take off, and that people will pass it along to others that they will think will appreciate it. It is historical fiction. It is family saga. It is life lessons to be learned and stories that can influence you today and still have relevance to today in so many ways.
Yes, it does. We should mention that Your first name is R-O-N-I, for those who are looking things up.
And Robin's plural.
Right.
R-O-B. Yes, with two B's.
Oh, there we go.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun talking with you, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading the story. And we look forward to the sequel.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your attention to this and your time also. This opportunity is amazing.
We'll send you the link. Yeah. I want to say thanks to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
Yes. Thank you for joining us on Let Me Tell You a Story. And remember, you too have a story. Be sure to live it to the fullest.
Thank you for listening to Let Me Tell You a Story. Please email your comments, suggestions, and submissions to story@beckylyles.com. That's all for now. Tune in next time to enjoy a fresh assortment of stories on Let Me Tell You a Story.